Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on billions for the bankers and debts for the people right after this. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs encompass the second and the eighth planks to the Communist Manifesto. That's a foreign and alien ideology. Our traditional American values are individual responsibility in place of Social Security and tithing in place of the income tax. Now, these foreign and alien ideologies require of us that we violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant. We're taught to covet our neighbor's property and call that income redistribution. We steal from our neighbors with unjust weights and measures called Federal Reserve Notes. Then we practice idolatry by signing contracts with these foreign and alien gods that we call government. And we're not getting away with our crimes either. We're now paying up to 75% of everything that we create and produce in taxes. And we live in mortgaged homes, homes that are owned by savings and loan companies. We drive cars, but they're owned by GMAC, or Ford Motor Finance. And the average family of four here in the United States has a $70,000 consumer debt. We owe $13 trillion in our national debt. And then we're surety for another $100 trillion of unfunded government obligations. And our financial institutions are leveraged out to $1,000 trillion worldwide. Our Social Security retirement system is a chain letter Ponzi scheme, and we live from paycheck to paycheck. And then we've been taught to call all of this prosperity. Well, the God of Israel gave us a better way than that, and our founding fathers followed that better way in Article 1, Section 10 of our Constitution by giving us gold and silver coin. Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status and a better way of life, why don't you call for our free 4-hour compact disc package? It's free. It's the place to start. It's educational. It's entertaining. It's informative. And best of all, it doesn't cost you anything. It's free of charge. You can call right now and order one. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Again, that's georgegordon.org, and go to the archives page. Hey, last time we were talking about this thing of the debt can't be paid back. In our monetary system here in the United States, and indeed worldwide, we have a debt-credit monetary system. It's not a hard money system. It's paper money. It's fiat currency, fiat money, just money created right out of thin air. And it looks like a good program. It's genius. It is genius. It has deceived everybody in the world. Everybody in the world practices it. And you won't find one person in 100, probably not even one in 1,000, that can tell you how that system works. So let me show you how that program pans out. How does this thing work? There was a guy who told me a story one time, and it really illustrates the point. There's five guys, and they're on a desert island. And they have divided up the desert island. One guy's got the coconuts. One guy's got the papayas. One guy's got the bananas. Another guy over here, he's got the fish. One of the guys on the island is a banker. He's a parasite. He doesn't want to work. And the four guys are sitting around the campfire with the banker, and they're musing about how they miss recreation. They miss entertainment. They miss cards. Know what we would give if we had a deck of cards that we could play with. Well, the banker perks right up, and he says, "Well, boys, your lucky day is here because I have a deck of cards." And the boys say, "Well, let's play." And the banker said, "Not so fast there, boys. I've got the only deck of cards here on the island. And I'm entitled to be paid for the use of my cards." And the boys agreed. And they said, "Well, yeah, we'll pay you for your cards. What do you want?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to divide the cards up into four piles. We'll give 13 cards each to each of you players. And then I'm going to lend these cards to you, and I want you to pay me one card as interest." Now, there's 52 cards in the deck. So he divides them up, spades, clubs, hearts, and diamonds, 13 cards each, one for each suit. And once the boy has agreed to this, he says, "One more thing I want. I want you to pledge to me your collateral, that you're going to pay me the amount that we agree to. In other words, when you get through playing cards, I want you to each pay me one extra card. When you get through playing the cards," some of you are going to have more cards than others, "and when you get through playing cards, you know, you give me back my 13 cards plus one, 13 cards plus one, 13 cards plus one, and 13 cards plus one." And they said, "Well, that sounds like a fair enough deal. We only have to pay one card." Now, he says, to guarantee me that you're going to pay me this one card, I want you to pledge me your banana trees, I want you to pledge me your papaya trees, and I want you to pledge me your fishing boat, and I want you to pledge me your pineapples. So each one of the four card players pledges to the banker that he will pay him back the 13 cards that he's borrowing plus one card interest. And to guarantee it, he promises, each one of these four players promises, that he will pledge his farm for security, his property for security. So the deal is made, and the cards are passed out, and the boys play. And then when they get through playing, just picture this. You're going to play a game of canasta, a game of pinochle. You know that when you play the cards around the table, you know, one guy takes a trick, and the next guy takes a trick, and then the next guy takes a trick, and pretty soon when you get all through, all the cards have been, then we count them up. And so the first guy, he counts up his cards over here, and he's got 20 cards. So he turns to the banker, and he says, okay, here's 14 cards. And the second guy, he ends up with 14 cards, and so he turns to the banker, and he hands the banker the 14 cards. That's 13 plus 1. So there's 20, and then 14. And then the third guy, he got 14 cards, and so he pays his 13 plus 1. So that's 20, 30, 40, and 4 and 4 is 8. That's 48 cards. Now the fifth player in the game, he's only got four cards. He cannot pay back the 13 cards plus one. So the banker takes his four cards and his pineapple plantation here on the island. In other words, he forecloses on the collateral. Now, it could be that one of the players will end up with far more and the other three players will end up not being able to pay off. But in any event, it doesn't make any difference whether it's one or it's three. One of them will always win, and one of them will always lose, and the banker will always take in the collateral. That's the way this game is played. So if you borrowed money and you paid your house off, that's great. And if you borrowed money and you paid your car off, well, that's great. But you see, there was a number of people that couldn't pay their cars off and couldn't pay their houses off because there was never enough money in the economy to pay all of the debt. There was enough money in the economy that when people bought, sold, and traded, that most of them would be able to pay off their debts, but there were always some of them that could not. Now, you take a look in society today. You have a shortage of money, and that's caused by the banks. Then you're playing the game, and some of the players, that is Boeing Aircraft and General Motors and others, they're able to pay off. And then the little guys down here that have their houses in Las Vegas, not all of them are able to pay off. And that's because when the banker lent into circulation the 52 cards, he said, I want each one of you to pay me one card interest. That's four more cards. So the four players have to pay back 56 cards, but there's only 52 cards in the game, and that's what's going on here in the banking industry. You see, the bank lends out. This is our central bank in Washington, D.C. See, they lend out, let's say, $10 billion. And that's 6% interest. Now, you and I go in there, and we borrow the money along with thousands of other people, and all of us are buying, selling, and trading. And when it comes time to pay back this $10 billion, there's $10 billion there, all right. Now, the banker's going to collect his $10 billion. But you got to have $10 billion and $60 million. So you've got to have $60 million to pay the interest. And there isn't $10 billion, $60 million out there. There's only $10 billion, period. So those that are short and unable to pay back will have their collateral foreclosed on. So here's the way the game is played. The banker creates the $10 billion out of thin air. Remember how that was done? See, he goes to the Treasury, and the Treasury says that we need to borrow $10 billion. And so the Treasury issues $10 billion in bonds. The bank buys the bonds and just creates the $10 billion for the Treasury to spend to send you out your Social Security checks because they didn't collect enough in taxes. But the bank, the central bank says we got to be paid back $10 billion and $60 million. And there isn't $10 billion and $60 million out there. There's only $10 billion. And so all of us that are buying, selling, and trading out here in the marketplace, here in America, are going to be $60 million short, which means that they're going to take our collateral. Now get this. Let's suppose that you've got a house and it's worth $100,000. And you've paid $10,000 on it, but you owe $90,000. But you can't make your payments, and so they foreclose, and they take your house and your $10,000 that you've already paid. Now, let's suppose you've been paying on this house for a long time, and you only owe $10,000 on it, but you've paid $90,000 of it off, but you still owe $10,000. You can't make your payments, and so they foreclose. So they take your house and the $90,000 that you've paid on it. And remember, we've agreed to this by law. So the banker is using the law and the Congress to make the laws and write the rules and regulations. Then they lend us the cards, we put the cards into play, and some of us can't pay off. But you see, because the majority of us can pay off, we believe that it's a sound system, and that the minority that cannot pay off, we say, well, you guys are just spoil sports. This is a hell of a neat game. We love it. And so they've been selling this for thousands of years. It works like a shot, but the creator of the universe did this. He already did his arithmetic, and he said in Leviticus 25, verses 36 and 37, he says, take you no usury of him or increase, but fear your God, that your brother may live with you. You shall not give him your money upon usury, nor lend him thy victuals for increase. And in Deuteronomy 23, verse 19, you shall not lend upon usury to your brother, usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. And the answer, boys and girls, is because there's going to be some losers out there that can't pay off. It's a sophisticated methodology for theft. Works like a shot for the bankers. They love it. And I can understand that, and I can understand why they'd want to keep it. The bankers, in turn, bribe the politicians. They give them campaign contributions to enact the laws and rules and regulations, like the TARP program, where they went out and they bailed out the banks. But look at what the TARP program did to you. Think about it for a minute. The banks said, look, we're short $15 trillion. And we need the government to go out and borrow the money and give us $15 trillion. So they did that. And the banks are holding all these mortgages against these houses. And they said, because these people aren't paying the mortgages on these houses, we're going to lose this $15 trillion, and that'll destroy the banking system and destroy the economy. And we don't want to do that, and neither do the people of America. So government, give us $15 trillion. Now let's back up for a minute and let's think of this. Who's going to lend the $15 trillion to the banks? Well, isn't that the people of America who are unable to pay for their houses? Or so many of the people of America that can't pay for their houses that the economy is going to collapse as a result of it? Wouldn't it have made more sense for the government, that's you and me and all the taxpayers out here, to go ahead and give the $15 trillion? We'll borrow it. All of us, butchers and bakers and candlestick makers and the moms and pops of America and the crap dealers, you know, and the maids that are working in the motels, we'll all underwrite this $15 trillion. That's what we did anyway, and then lend it to the banks. But instead of doing that, let's lend the $15 trillion to those Americans that have the mortgages on the houses and can't pay for them. Then those people can pay the bankers off, and they will own their homes free and clear. Now, one-third of Americans own their homes free and clear, and two-thirds of Americans don't, but if we borrowed $15 trillion, then everybody in America would own his home free and clear, and the banks now would have the $15 trillion, wouldn't they? So then they've been paid off, and the people that owe this $15 trillion can then pay the government over time that $15 trillion back, you know, in 30 or 40 years. Hell, it could be interest-free. We'll just add it to your tax bill every year, you know. We could have done that, and you'd have the same result, except that the banks would all be paid off, all the people of America would be free and clear, and they would owe a stipend to pay on their income tax every year until we reduce the $15 trillion national debt down to zero. All right? Now, we didn't do that. We went out and borrowed the $15 trillion on top of all the collateral that we'd promised the banks. The banks got the $15 trillion, and now they won't lend it out, and they've still got the mortgage on your house. And if you don't pay the mortgage on your house, then they're going to take your house away from you. So you lost the $15 trillion and your house. Does that make any sense? Now, that's why Sheldon Emery wrote this little book called Billions for the Bankers and Debts for the People, The Cause for Inflation. And it's because when they loan the money into circulation, they're bringing it right out of thin air. Now, let's try God's system over here, and I'll show you how that one works. We need money to buy, sell, and trade with. Some people go out into the world, and they dig in the ground, and they bring up gold and silver. The amount of labor that they expend on gold and silver is offset by the labor that they expended to dig it out of the ground. Now, the miner, in order to dig out more gold and silver, needs lumber to build shoring inside of his mine. So he trades the gold that he's getting out of the ground to the logger and the lumberjack to go cut down trees and make the shoring for the miner. Now, the logger and the lumberjack have gold coin, and they go out to the farmer, the candlestick maker and the butcher and the baker, and they buy from those people, who in turn use the gold coin as a medium of exchange. There's no interest involved in it. It's a medium of exchange. It has value of and by itself and in itself. Gold is valuable. Candles are valuable. Meat's valuable. Wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. Logs and lumber are valuable. Everything has a value. And the economy is perfectly balanced. There's never any inflation, and everybody gets along just fine. And that's what happened in America from 1787 to 1933. We had gold and silver coin. Miners went out and mined the coin. They spent their labor digging in the ground. The loggers and lumberjacks spent their labor cutting down trees and making lumber so we could build houses, shore up the mine so that we could mine more gold, so we'd have more gold to exchange. We had more money. Money comes into circulation then by labor. Now, along come the bankers, and they said, what we need is a central bank. What we need is a private bank called the Federal Reserve Bank, and we will print your money in paper, and it'll be a lot lighter, and you won't have to carry all that heavy gold around. Give us that franchise, and we did. And now look at what we've got. We've got a $13 trillion national debt. We've got $100 trillion debt in derivatives. We have another, no, that's $100 trillion in debt and derivatives. We have $1,000 trillion in derivatives and $100 trillion that we owe for all of the rest of the unfunded debts. We have debt upon debt upon debt. We're just totally insolvent. In fact, the whole world is insolvent. But the banks hold all the mortgages on all of the property on planet Earth. Now listen to this little story. When the Babylonian civilization collapsed, 3% of the people owned all of the wealth. And when Persia went down to destruction, 2% of the people owned all of the wealth. When ancient Greece went down to ruin, 0.5% of the people owned all of the wealth. And when the Roman Empire fell by the wayside, 2,000 people owned all of the wealth of the civilized world. Now, it's said at this time, less than 2% of the people of America control 90% of the wealth of America. Now, these bankers that own these mortgages, these bankers that create this money out of thin air, it's a hell of a neat deal for them, and I don't blame them for loving it. It's a great deal for politicians. It's a great deal for big businessmen. But you and I, Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, have to pay all of that. And they've got the whip hand over us. And this is not a good plan for us. And in fact, God told us that. Our Creator told us, don't do that. But of course, you and I are smarter than God, and so we said, go suck an egg there, God, and we'll do our thing. Well, now, James A. Garfield reportedly said, whosoever controls the volume of money in any country is absolute master of all industry and commerce. The banking industry in America is the absolute master of all industry and commerce in the country. Now, Andrew Jackson is a guy that put an end to the bankers back in 1836, and here's what Jackson said. He said, gentlemen, I have had men watching you for a long time, and I'm convinced that you have used the funds of the bank to speculate in the breadstuffs of the country. And when you won, you divided the profits amongst yourselves, and when you lost, you charged it to the bank. Now you tell me that if I take the deposits from the bank and annul its charter, I shall ruin 10,000 families. And that may be true, but that's your sin. Should I let you go on, you will ruin 50,000 families, and that would be my sin. You are a den of vipers and thieves, and I have determined to rout you out, and by the eternal God, I will rout you out. That's why the bankers hated Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson, they just hated him. And Jackson was a champion of hard money, and he was opposed to the bankers and usury, which is exactly what our Creator told us. Now, along the way, somewhere along the way, we kind of lost sight of that, and then we went into this Federal Reserve Bank program back in 1913, and there's been a result that comes from that. You know, back in 1913, sounded like a good idea. In 1910, the U.S. federal debt was about $1 billion, or $12.40 for every citizen. State and local debts were practically non-existent. By 1920, after only 6 years of Federal Reserve operations, the federal debt had jumped to $24 billion, or $228 per person. In 1960, the federal debt reached $284 billion, or about $1,575 per person, and the state and local debts were mushrooming. By 1981, the federal debt passed $1 trillion and was growing exponentially, that is, geometrically, 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. So, as the bankers tripled the interest rate. Now, state and local debts are now more than the federal debt, and with business and personal debts totaling over $6 trillion, that's three times the value of all the land and billions in America, buildings in America. So, if you took all the land in the country, this 3,500,000 square miles, 3,500,000 sections of land, and all the buildings that are on them, they're not worth the amount of money that we owe. Now, this little book was written back in 1980. And today, if you were to sit down and add up all the debt, here's what it is. Just write this down in trillions. The national debt that's funded is 13. The unfunded debt is 100. That's $113 trillion, and that's just the federal government. Now, the state of California, and then Illinois, New York, and all the states in the union, they've all got debt. And then all the counties have debt, and then all the cities have some debt. Now add all of that debt up, and it's more than the $113 trillion that the government owes, so we'll write another $113. Now that's $226 trillion, and that's right on top. Then on top of that, the banks are leveraged out to it's $1,000 trillion in derivatives. That's a quadrillion. And then you can add to that what you owe on your mortgage and your automobile and your consumer debt and credit cards and whatever you got. And then people say, this is America, the land of the free, the home of the brave, the richest nation in the world. You know, we've lost our minds. We are not the richest nation in the world. We're the poorest because we owe more debt. Now, it's true we're driving around in better cars and living in better houses, but all of that's being stripped away. Just pay attention. Watch now what's happening. It's being taken away from us. And the banks are foreclosing. Now, their motivation is they see a utopian world, a utopian communist world in which all the nations of the world will be operated through the United Nations, a one-world government with one currency, one government, one parliament. one taxing system. And hell, maybe this is a great idea. I'm not sitting here trying to second guess it. The creator of the universe, God, you know, he decided he didn't like that back in Genesis 11. He confounded our languages and separated us into nations. And from that day forward, we've been working mightily now to create this one world government again. We had a one world government back there at the Tower of Babel, and God said, that's not a good idea. I don't like it. And so he confounded it. Now we're about to do it again. And I suspect he's probably going to do about the same thing again. Well, according to Matthew 24, that's what he's telling us. So now if you're wondering why you're losing your house and why you're losing your job and why the economy is upside down, it's because of usury. You can't do that. It's like trying to drive your car at 90 miles an hour around a 35-mile-an-hour curve. You may be sitting there saying, but I've got the most advanced suspension in the world. I'm driving a 280Z. I don't understand why I can't go 90 miles an hour around this 35-mile-an-hour curve. Well, there's a thing called physics here. There's laws that come into play here. That won't work. Now, you may say, well, it should work. Well, maybe it should. I don't know. But I wasn't able to do it in my 47 Plymouth, and David Wagner couldn't do it in his 46 Chevy, and Mike Lyons couldn't do it in his 37 Buick, and Ronnie Quillen couldn't do it in his 49 Merck. And so, you know, there's those of us out there that have tested it and tried it, and it didn't work for us, and so we come along and say, well, I'd suggest that you slow down at least to 45 or 50. You know, it'd be better if you slowed down to 35, but if you just have to speed around this corner, you know, don't try it at 90, because when we did it, we flew off the road, and it didn't work for us. So the same thing is true here for usury. You know, we've been doing this for 5,000 years, and it didn't work for the Babylonians or the Egyptians or the Greeks or the Romans. It hasn't worked here in the United States. We tried this in 1695, I believe it was, to about 1756. We tried it from 1756 to 1783. And now we've tried it again from 1913 to 33, and it collapsed. And then from 33 to the present. And it's in the process of disintegrating in front of our eyeballs. Now, it takes a long time for these civilizations, these empires, to collapse. But they do. And then when they do, it causes a lot of weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. And people are sad. And they're losing their houses. And they're out in the streets. And they're just unhappy and miserable about it. But, you know, we brought it upon ourselves. And we knew or should have known that this wasn't going to work when Franklin Roosevelt proposed it to us back in 1933. But we re-elected him in 36. Re-elected him in 40, re-elected him again in 44. So evidently, our grandfathers, our fathers and grandfathers thought that it was going to work. And we've been plugging along now until today. And I'm sure that most of you people out there believe that it's going to work, or at least you hope it does. But it's never worked in history. Usury and interest has never worked in history, and we've been doing it for 5,000 years that we've got recorded numbers on, or 4,000 anyway. And so some of us, and I'm one of them, I looked at this some years back and I said, well, I think I'll quit doing that. And I'm going to go back to hard money. I'm going to go back to gold and silver, and I did. And I'm happy with my decision. I opened a law school, and in the school, we have one class on business. And that one class or one school on business deals almost, well, not exclusively, but, you know, in great part, upon the use of a gold and silver coin, which, by the way, in all of the Anglo-Saxon countries, you know, like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, Great Britain, we have gold coin. We've all got gold and silver coin. Hell, they're minting and printing it every day. So, you know, if you don't have your share, or if you're not using it, you know, that's your choice in life, and it isn't that it's not available. Now, again, this little book that I'm reading from here, called Billions for the Bankers, Debts for the People. I'm going to give the guy credit, and it was written, the guy that wrote it's dead, his name is Sheldon Emery, died 20 years ago, or 30 now, he'd been around, he's been gone for a long time. But I think his church, the Lord's Covenant Church, is still in operation out in Scottsdale, Arizona. Why don't you give it a try? It's called Lord's Covenant Church, America's Promise Broadcast, Post Office Box 5334, Phoenix, Arizona, 85010. If you go online and look for Lord's Covenant Church or America's Promise Broadcast, see if it's still available. It either is or it isn't. Sheldon Emery is the guy's name. Emery was his last name. And in any event, I'm going to cover most of it for you here. So, by 1981, the federal debt passed $1 trillion and was growing exponentially. Now, if we signed over to the money lenders all of America, we would still owe them two more Americas plus their usury. So you can forget about paying this debt off. I mean, that's a lost cause. It's a dead letter issue. However, they're too cunning to take title to everything. They will instead leave you with some. They will leave you with the illusion of ownership so that you and your children will continue to work and pay the bankers more of your earnings on ever-increasing debts. The establishment, that is, the powers that be, has captured our people with their ungodly system of usury and debt, as certainly as if they had marched in with a uniformed army. To understand it really is a conquest, let's go back to the front and read the three types of conquest again. Now, for the gamblers among my readers, to grasp the truth that periodic withdrawal of money through interest payments will inexorably transfer all wealth in the nation to the receiver of interest, imagine yourself in a poker or dice game where everyone must buy the chips, that's the medium of exchange, from a banker who does not risk chips in the game but watches the table, and every hour he reaches in and takes 10 to 15% of all the chips on the table. Now, as the game goes on, the amount of chips in the possession of each player will go up and down with his luck. However, the total number of chips available to play the game, that is, carry on trade and business, will decrease rapidly. The game will get low on chips, and someone will have to run out. Now, if they want to continue to play, they must buy or borrow them from the banker. Well, the banker will sell or lend them only if the player signs a mortgage agreeing to give the banker some real property. That's his car, his home, his farm, or his business. And if he cannot make periodic payments to pay back all of the chips plus some extra ones, that's interest, then the payment must be made on time, whether he wins, that is, makes a profit or not. So if you've ever played cards in a card room, let's suppose that the four of us want to play cards. Here's what happens. We walk in and there's a cashier, and we all start off, let's say, with $100. You put your $100 down. The cashier gives you chips. She'll give you $100 worth of chips. Let's call all of these chips a dollar chip, and she gives you 100 chips. There's four of us, so she passes out 400 chips. So we go over and we sit down and we start playing cards. Now, depending upon the luck of the game, you know, some of us are going to end up with 150 chips and some of us are going to end up with no chips. But every 15 minutes, as we're sitting here in the card room, renting this card table is what we're doing. We're renting the card table. They don't take any interest from you when you buy the chips. You put a $100 bill down, she gives you 100 chips. The chips are worth a dollar each. When you walk back up, when you cash out and put your 150 or 200 chips down, she'll count them out and give you 150 or 200 in Federal Reserve notes as you walk out the door. But every 15 minutes, the house man comes by and he takes one chip from every player in the house. Every 15 minutes. So it costs each player $4 an hour to sit there and play cards. There's four players at our table, so every hour it costs us $16 an hour. And that's the way the house makes its money. They make $16 an hour on each card table that's in operation. So assuming they got a room here with 10 card tables in it, they're making $160 an hour, aren't they? Well, that's what the banker is doing. Whether he's lending you money on your house or he's lending money, you know, to the government, it doesn't make any difference. He's making his money on that interest, on that commission. And that's what we're doing here in the country. And we have to go out, you and I. And we have to actually go out and produce cattle. And we have to work and plow and farm and plant and grow tomatoes in order to make those $100 bills to go down to the card room so we can play cards. Now, what these bankers are doing, they're playing the game based upon the economy. They're using the economy. Instead of chips, they're using Federal Reserve notes. Hey, we're about halfway through here. Let me give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's eight schools and all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Then click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. In the Law Hour, an editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or the publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and editorial review, they may be hostile, political, religious, they can be economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. 67. All right, we're talking about billions for the bankers and debts for the people. That's where we're at in the world today. So I thought I'd explain from the point of view from the scripture and from the banker's point of view, here's why this game works this way, so that you can understand why they're taking your house, why you're unemployed, and why you're in debt up to your eyeballs. You knew, or you should have known, that this would be the ultimate end game if you played the usury and interest game. Now, a lot of people play the game, and they win, as is evidenced by people like Donald Trump. He plays the game, and he wins, and he's what we call an insider. The people at Goldman Sachs, the people that come out of the Ivy League colleges that go to work for Boeing aircraft and so on, these insiders who play the game have oftentimes inside information. So when they're buying stocks and bonds and one thing and another, you know, like Hillary Clinton and Rahm Emanuel, these people, when they come into politics, you know, they don't have very much money. One of the guys that scored really big was Al Gore. Now, Al Gore, while he was vice president of the United States, he had a few bucks. He had $3, $4, $5 million. But today, he has over $100 million. And the way that money is given to these people is that they get into the stock market and they have these insider tips. And so they can't lose because they know how the game is going to come out. And the people that rig the game, you know, the stock markets, those are rigged games. These commodity markets, those are rigged games. And the president, President Reagan, he created an outfit called the Plunge Protection Team. Plunge Protection Team. That's the Working Group on Financial Markets or something like that's the official name. Well, those guys, they rig the markets day in and day out with taxpayer dollars. And so it looks good. It's a fraud, but it looks good. And then when you tell people this, they look at you and say, oh, no, they wouldn't do that in America. Now, take a look at your foreclosures. Take a look at what's going on around you over here. And, yes, they would do that in America. And, yes, they are doing that here in America and in Great Britain and in Australia and Brazil and every place else. Now, the game, you know, when it gets low on chips, it's easy to see that no matter how skillfully they play, eventually the banker will end up with all of his original chips. And except for the very best players, the rest, if they stay in long enough, will lose to the banker their homes, their farms, their businesses, and perhaps even their cars, watches, rings, and the shirts off their backs. Now, our real-life situation is much worse than the poker game. In a poker game, no one is forced to go into debt, and anyone can quit at any time and keep whatever he still has. But out here in real life, even if we borrow a little ourselves from the bankers, the local, state, and federal governments borrow billions in our name, and then they turn around and squander it. And then they confiscate our earnings from us and taxes and then pay that to the bankers with interest. So you and I are forced to play the game, and no one can leave except by death. Now, we pay as long as we live, and our children pay after we die. Now, if we cannot pay, the same government sends the police to take our property and give it to the bankers. The bankers never risk anything. They're never playing in the game. They just collect their percentage, and they win it all. In Las Vegas and in other gambling centers, all of the games are rigged to pay the owner a percentage, and they make millions and millions of dollars. Well, the Federal Reserve Bankers game is also rigged, but it pays off in billions of dollars. In recent years, bankers added real cards to their game, and they're called credit cards. Credit cards are promoted as a convenience and a great boon to trade. Actually, credit cards are a very ingenious device by which bankers collect 2 to 5% of every retail sale from the seller and 18% interest from the buyers. That's a real stack to deck. Now, let me show you how this rule of 72 works, because a lot of times people, they come into class here, you know, and they're in debt. And the first thing we have to do is get them out of debt. I tell people when they walk in the door, I say, you know, if you're at zero COD, we can go to work in the morning and start making money. And in about 36 months, it takes about 3 years, you can have $100,000 in gold buried in a hole in the ground. But when people walk in the door, they're in debt $200,000, $300,000, $400,000. Hell, we can't even start to make money. The banker's already taken it all. And then when they say, oh, my God, I lost my home, I say, you lucky fellow, you. They took away the debt. See, you couldn't service the debt, so they took away your house, which was the cause of your debt. You should thank God, you know, that you're so fortunate. They look at you like you're stupid, you know. People go out shopping for a mortgage. I hear that term all the time. Well, we're out shopping for a mortgage, which is like saying, I'm out shopping for handcuffs. I'm out shopping for slavery. I can't wait to put myself into voluntary servitude. You know, I want to join the army so I can become a credit debt serf. I don't know. You know, I guess it's the way you're raised, the way you're brought up, the way you're taught and trained. But the bottom line is that we need to be debt-free. See, the bankers, they don't have debt. They're debt-free. They're collecting. But the rule of 72 works like this. Let's suppose that you owe the bank $10,000. And you're paying interest on that at the rate of, let's say, 15%, which I think is what the Discover card is. That's the lowest rate there is, about 10. Let's just call it 10%. And I think there are some credit cards, when they initially give them to you, they give them to you at a cut rate price, 11% interest. So what you do is you take 72 and plug it into your Texas Instruments Sharp EL1197G3. Okay, and divide that by 10, and it'll take you 7.2 years to retire that debt. That's a 10% interest. Or put another way, your $10,000 debt and a 10% interest will double every 7.2 years. All right, so let's suppose that you're making your minimum payments of 2%. I think they raised it now to 5, but they used to have a minimum payment, 2%. When I had credit cards, the minimum payment was 10%. So if you owed these guys, say it was $700, you'd have to make a $70 a month payment. You just pay 10% of what the balance is. Now, your interest rate can go up to as high as 30%. It's very common to have interest rates of 18, 20, 22, 25, 27, 29% interest on these credit cards. So let's take a 30% interest credit card, and that 72 divided by 30 is 2.4 years. So every 2.5 years, the debt doubles at 30%. You can never pay that off. I mean, you got to hustle. There was a young woman came in here. She's a doctor. She makes $100 an hour. She works 48 hours a week. At $100 an hour. She makes $4,800 a week. 48 times 52. That's $2.496 million a year. Isn't that right? Let me try that again. 4,800 times 52 weeks. No, that's $249,600 a year. It's $250,000 a year. $250,000 a year. And that's what that is. So on $250,000 a year, and she has a student loan, then the student loan is calculated daily. It has daily interest attached to it. And we calculated that out, and this lady making her payments, and I forgot what they were now, it was, I don't know, $500-$600 a month. It'll take her 28 years to amortize that loan off. She's going to pay somewhere in the neighborhood of three times the amount that she borrowed. When she borrowed $100,000, and she's going to pay back $400,000. So she's going to pay back about two full years of her wages for that loan. Something on that order. All right, now that's what interest does. Interest is great. Interest, you know, if you're collecting it, it's the greatest thing since sliced white bread. If you're paying it, there's about three or four different ways to calculate it. Simple interest is where you borrow $100 and you pay back 6% interest, simple interest, and you pay back 106 at the end of 365 days. But then they've got add-on interest and APR and all these little names that they hang on there. And what that boils down to is that in some cases, I remember we had one that was called add-on interest. And when a customer came into my store and he said, well, what's the interest rate? I'd say it's 12% add-on. Where can you get an interest rate of 12% these days? This is back in the 70s when interest rates were 21%. And God, they just loved it. They just fell for it hook, line, and sinker. But see, nobody ever asked me what add-on meant. So add-on is the way we calculate the interest. You know, we calculate it daily. 12% add-on, we add that interest on to the balance daily. So we multiply that out times 360. And then when you get all through, the simple interest is 34% per annum. So it's not the regular 21% that you're paying down at the bank. It's 34%. Isn't that special? So I just thought I'd point out some of these little tricks because, you know, we go to public school and they teach us that interest and usury are good for us. And then we should have a checking account and do business with the bank. See, the bankers train their customers. They train their customers from kindergarten up. So by the time you get to college, you're perfectly comfortable with borrowing money and doing business at the bank. I was taught and trained to do business with the bank, and the bankers are good guys, and they love you, and they're doing everything they can to help you. And I heard that story, too. And then I learned how to count. I learned how to count from Milton Kagan, the kike from the Bronx. That's what he called himself, kike from the Bronx. Milton taught me how to count. I was 37 years old, and once I learned how to count, I haven't been the same since. So Sheldon Emery, somewhere along the line, he learned how to count. And God, the Creator, somewhere along the line, he learned how to count, and he said, hey, if you do business with these guys, they're going to eat you out of house and home. And we're at that point in history where the bankers are eating us out of house and home. But that's the bad news. Now, the good news is, you know, we can stop doing that anytime we get ready. I don't think we're going to turn the nation around. I don't think you can save California. I mean, you know, you can vote for Arnold Schwarzenegger or Jerry Brown or somebody else if you want, but I don't think that's going to solve your problem. But any of you people in California, you can solve your problem right there at the family level, and it'll take you 36 months, and you'll have $100,000 in gold buried in a hole in the ground. But you got to get out and go to work now. I mean, I'm not telling you that you just sit on your hiney and watch TV and get rich and do nothing. I mean, you got to get out and hustle. Now, Democrats, Republicans, and independent voters who have wondered why politicians always spend more tax money than they take in should now see the reason. When they begin to study our debt money system, they soon realize that these politicians are not the agents of the people, but they're the agents of the bankers, for whom they plan always to place the people further in debt. It takes only a little imagination to see that if Congress had been creating and spending or issuing into circulation the necessary increase in the money supply, there wouldn't be any national debt. You see, boys and girls, if the bankers can create these bonds and this paper money, well, then the Treasury can do the same thing, and you don't need to charge any interest to. So when the politicians give this franchise to these bankers, it's a you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. And about 96% of incumbent politicians are reelected, and they get their money for these elections from the bankers. Now, they get a lot of it also from the merchants, that is Boeing Aircraft and the big multinational corporations, who the Congress writes the laws for so that they can make these killer profits. Because, you know, when you're buying a toilet seat for $600, well, who in the hell's paying for that? It's you and me, the taxpayers. So these $600 toilet seats and $400 nuts and bolts, you know, that these corporations are selling to the Pentagon and the Defense Department and so on, and that's just part of the rigging that goes into the program. And when you get a belly full of it and you say, well, I think I'll go back and practice the Ten Commandments and the laws of God, you can get off this merry-go-round anytime you want. But most people don't want to get off the merry-go-round. They love it, and they want to stay right on it. Well, it doesn't take very much imagination to see that $4 trillion of other debts would be practically non-existent, since there would be no original cost of money except printing and no continuing costs such as interest. Federal taxes would be almost nil. Money, once in circulation, would remain there and go on serving its purpose as a medium of exchange for generation after generation and century after century, just as coins do now, with no payments to the bankers whatsoever. So we don't have to pay the bankers a dime. We don't have to have a national debt. That's a rigged game that we've agreed to for the benefit of the bankers and the politicians. And once we understand how the game is played, then you can better determine for yourself, do I want to stay in this game or get the hell out? Hey, I'm out of time, so I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by pre-arrangement. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed on our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. I'm going to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.